The history has shown that immigrants and refugees will again be toyed with. They will be used as political fodder. They will be we become the threat of this country, and many of us are just tired of it, which is why we want to change the narrative entirely. But definitely, after all of that, be sure you go and listen to USA versus Garcia Luna, because it is mind-blowing. As we say, it's true crime meets telenovela. It's so crazy we had to bring out a bottle of tequila, because there was just no way to understand this story unless we were able to have a little tequila along with it.
Well, Maria Hinojosa, we want to thank you for being with us, as well as Penile Ramirez. Your series are amazing. We will link to the new investigative podcast, Death by Policy in USA versus Garcia Luna. And congratulations on your memoir for young people, Once I Was You, Maria. That does it for our show. Juan, I can't wait for Friday. Juan Gonzalez is speaking at CUNY, City University of New York School of Labor and Urban Studies, at 3 p.m. You can check our website for the address. And also on Monday at 6:30 p.m. at the CUNY Graduate Center. We want to thank you, Juan, for these remarkable speeches. Also, a new Spanish edition of Juan's classic book, Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America, has just come out. Check it out. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzdi. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Dear KABU listeners, fantastic KABU community, we want to inform you that right now our phone system is offline. Again, at the moment, our phone system is entirely offline. Our engineering department is tackling this issue with urgency. We apologize for any inconvenience, and thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO's end of year drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO. OO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Join the KABU family today at kboo.fm/give.
This is KBOO Portland. Time now for your evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KABU Evening News, Oregon's gun control measure is stalled by conflicting federal and state court decisions.
Portland city attorneys adopt a new tactic to avoid paying out protesters.
And traffic deaths are up in the Pacific Northwest, and we'll learn more about some of the causes.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. KABU is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Andrew Black.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Well, there's been quite a bit of flip-flopping on Oregon's recently passed gun control measure 114. Early yesterday, a federal judge ruled that measure 114 could take effect on Thursday with a 30-year delay on the requiring of a permit to purchase a gun. But 3 hours later, Harney County Judge Robert Ratio granted a restraining order against all parts of the measure. Fast forward to this morning, when Oregon's Attorney General filed a petition urging the state Supreme Court to order Judge Ratio to throw out his restraining order blocking the measure on the grounds that the block exceeded Ratio's authority. Assistant Attorney General Robert Koch wrote that, quote, an immediate stay is needed to stop the threat to public safety that the temporary restraining order created and to prevent public confusion about the legal status of large capacity magazines in Oregon, end quote. Measure 114 enacts a permanent permit to buy a gun, a ban on the sale, transfer, and manufacture of magazines holding more than 10 rounds and requires a background check before any sale or transfer of a gun.
A number of lawsuits remain unresolved as a result of the police actions against protesters in the 2020 Portland racial justice protests. In the latest one, city attorneys are adopting a novel tactic. They want to use a loophole in Oregon law to absolve Portland of financial responsibility for police brutality. This is in a civil suit brought by protester Megan Obrook, who was severely injured by a flashbang in June of 2020 and sued the city for damages. The city's lawyers said a lawsuit should be thrown out because they argue that Portland can be sued once the police declare a riot. The loophole stems from sovereign immunity that comes from English common law. Think of the quote, "The king can do no wrong." There are limits to that immunity in the U.S., and in here, the Oregon Tort Claims Act allows Oregonians to sue the state with certain limitations. One of those is, quote, "any claim arising out of riot." Obrook's attorneys say, though, that the loophole was created in 1969 to protect governments from having to pay for the damages rioters cause, not to give police blanket immunity for harming protesters after they declare a riot. Lawmakers sought to close the loophole in 2020, but the language disappeared in the final draft of the bill.
The Pacific Northwest continues to see a large increase in the number of traffic fatalities, and policymakers are trying a variety of strategies in response. The traffic fatality rate reached a 20-year high last year for both Oregon and Washington. This year, the number of traffic fatalities is down slightly in Oregon, falling about 6% from last year's pace. In Washington, the number of deaths on the road continued to rise and is on track to pass 700 for the year. Washington Traffic Safety Commission Director Shelley Baldwin said, quote, "That'll be the highest numbers that we've seen since the 90s. It's a distressing place to find ourselves," end of quote. Crashes involving speeding, drugs or alcohol, distraction, and unfastened seatbelts all rose. Fatalities on the road surged early after the appearance of COVID-19. At the time, fewer speeding tickets were being written, at least partly because police were trying to minimize face-to-face contact. Many experts expected the numbers of deaths to fall as we emerged from the pandemic. However, while the number of drivers on the road is essentially back to where things were pre-COVID, citation rates have not returned to anything close to the pre-pandemic figures. Hiring and other workforce issues appear to be at blame. The Washington State Patrol had 521 available road troopers but wanted 683 on the road. Multiple factors contributed to the ongoing shortage, including the COVID vaccine mandate, retirements, attrition, and transfers to higher-paying police departments. Oregon has budget authorization for 530 road troopers, including sergeants, but only 450 of those positions are now filled.
Both Oregon and Washington received extra federal crash reduction monies from pandemic relief packages, but fully using the funds for new strategies has been hampered by police staff shortages. To improve the situation, legislators in a number of state capitals, including Washington, are discussing lowering the drunk driving limit from 0.08 to a 0.05 blood alcohol concentration. Some cities are lowering the speed limits on roads with high crash rates or adding speed bumps. In 2019, legislators in both Oregon and California considered but did not pass bills to lower the legal blood alcohol limit to 0.05. The large increase in the number of pedestrians and bicyclists killed is particularly notable. In Washington, 145 pedestrians were killed by vehicles in 2021, the highest number on record. This was nearly a one-third increase from 2020. Portland also suffered more pedestrian deaths than at any time in modern history last year. Around 70% of the victims were houseless.
Moving to national politics, where Democratic incumbent Senator Raphael Warnock won last night's runoff election in Georgia. He becomes the state's first Black full-term senator. This increases the Democrats' Senate majority to 51. The Associated Press called the race when Warnock was leading by 40,000 votes. Warnock told supporters, quote, "After a hard-fought campaign, or should I say campaigns, it is my honor to utter the four most powerful words ever spoken in a democracy. "The people have spoken," end quote. Despite harsh voting restrictions in that state, nearly 2 million Georgians cast ballots before Election Day, with those votes significantly favoring Warnock.
Raphael Warnock wins the Senate race in Georgia. The House holds hearings in the lame duck session, and Capitol Police officers receive medals for their heroism on January 6. With more on this story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
According to NBC News projections, that victory earns a 6-year term for Warnock and grants Democrats a 51-49 edge in the Senate. NBC News reports ahead of the Tuesday runoff, Warnock's campaign relied on an extensive get-out-the-vote effort. They note that Warnock, Georgia's first black senator, largely let Walker's often incoherent words speak for themselves. Walker's rambling speeches became prime campaign material for Warnock and his surrogates.
A record number of early votes were cast in the runoff. U.S. Capitol Police officers were awarded congressional gold medals for their heroism in the January 6th attack. D.C. Police Chief Robert J. Conte III spoke about how the officers will never forget that day.
Many of us still carry the physical, mental, and emotional scars after that mob of thousands launched a violent assault in an attempt to halt the counting of electoral ballots.
Representative Benny Thompson, chair of the House subcommittee investigating the attacks, said criminal referrals will be made based on the committee's findings. A report is expected to be released sometime before Christmas. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said time is running out to reach an agreement about a deal to fund the government. The current continuing resolution expires December 16th.
Time is ticking. We have not been able to agree on a top line yet, and I think it's becoming increasingly likely that we may need to do a short-term CR into early next year. We're running out of time, and that may end up being the only option left that we could agree to pursue.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said passing a budget will be an imperative goal of the lame duck Congress. He added there is bipartisan support and stressed the importance of the new National Defense Authorization Act.
This isn't an easy process, but it's important nonetheless. For the well-being of our troops, for the preservation of our national security, for the tens of millions of Americans who look to the federal government for a wide range of basic services.
A jury in New York found the Trump Organization guilty of conspiracy, criminal tax fraud, and falsifying business records. Lawyers for the company said they will appeal. The Trump Organization is still the subject of a criminal investigation by New York State Attorney General Letitia James. Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in the case of Moore v. Harper, which could shift the way American democracy operates. A ruling in the case would allow for the creation of hyperpartisan voting districts, which cannot be challenged under judicial review by state courts. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Closer to home, Democrats won some key races in rural areas where they generally struggle. Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez's success in a southern Washington race for a U.S. House seat provides evidence of how her party could win over some rural voters. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
Democrats have struggled to turn red rural areas blue across the country for years, but some left-leaning candidates won in 2022, raising the question of how they succeeded where many others have failed. In Washington, Democrat Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez flipped a red U.S. House seat in the southern part of the state. Amber Rosewood in Cowlitz County chairs the 19th Legislative District Democrats. Her organization partly coordinated with Gluzenkamp-Perez's campaign, but she notes that her group has been organizing year-round since 2018. She says it was important that Gluzenkamp-Perez's campaign did not attempt to take over her group's efforts.
You really just need to find the people that are already organizing, that are natural leaders, that have a group of people around them willing to do good work, and figure out how you can incorporate those efforts into your campaign.
The race for Washington State's 3rd Congressional District was one of the most hotly contested House races of the 2022 election. It had been represented by a Republican since 2010. The Rural Urban Bridge Initiative has released a report about what the keys to success for Democrats are in these areas. Group co-founder Anthony Flaccavento says one finding is that winning candidates were widely seen as engaged with the local community, whether they were fourth-generation residents or relative newcomers.
They had strong, what we call in the report, local fluency. They knew the community, they knew the history, they knew the language and the mores and the vernacular and all of that. They knew what mattered to the majority of people. And they, in one way or another, had been engaged with trying to make the community strong.
Rosewood says that's likely to be the case for any successful candidate in rural America.
We're all here in these rural communities. We care very much about where we live, and the resources we have are really important to us. And when a candidate can show that our issues are their issues, we want to work with them. We want to work hard for them. We want them to represent us.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Wisconsin is one of just five states that allows civil detention for pregnant people accused of drug or alcohol use. Critics say the so-called fetal protection laws are one often overlooked way the government exercises authority over pregnancy. Mike Moyne has a story.
Under a Wisconsin law, officials investigate about 400 pregnant people a year for alleged unborn child abuse. But critics say that can do more harm than good. The state law centers around situations where a pregnant individual is suspected of drug or alcohol use. One of the high-profile cases tied to the law involves Tammy Lorcher, who was jailed in 2014. The state contended she knowingly used drugs and alcohol while pregnant, but Lorcher insisted she stopped as soon as she learned of the pregnancy. The Taylor County Department of Human Services ended up issuing a request for temporary physical custody.
They said they were doing it for my baby, but they were hurting him too.
Those who enforce the law say it allows counties to begin working with pregnant individuals to help overcome challenges tied to substance use and limit the potential effects on an unborn child. But leading medical associations say these laws take a punitive approach. And a legal advocacy group says Wisconsin's is the most egregious of the civil statutes in the country. University of California Irvine law professor Michelle Bratcher Goodwin notes the effect these laws have on people who are poor or women of color, who are more likely to be involved with the child welfare or criminal justice systems.
It is worth noting, though, that they would not have been enacted if it hadn't been that the stereotypic face that the state was looking to restrict the constitutional rights of. If it didn't look indigenous, if it didn't look black.
Since its enactment, Wisconsin's fetal protection law has weathered two high-profile challenges. And while the law doesn't require county health officials or hospital workers to report such cases, a 2018 Pew study found Wisconsin practitioners commonly misinterpret their legal obligations, something researchers suggest the state should clarify. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program simply by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about a new article in the paper out today that details how eviction courts favor landlords and the role the court plays in the housing crisis. At 6, it's Exploration with Michio Kaku, then at 7, Paradigms. Tonight's weather will be cloudy and chilly and rainy with a low of 38. Tomorrow will also be cloudy and wet with a high of 43. Today in history, in 1972, Apollo 17, the last Apollo moon mission, was launched. The crew took the famous photograph known as the Blue Marble as they left the Earth. The quote of the day is from Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, who said, quote, "The Earth was small, light blue, and so touchingly alone, our home that must be defended like a holy relic. The Earth was absolutely round. I believe I never knew what the word round meant until I saw Earth from space."
Indonesia's parliament banned sex outside marriage with a punishment of up to 1 year in jail on Tuesday. Part of the country's new criminal code also prohibits cohabitation by unmarried couples. That will apply to Indonesians and foreigners alike. These changes would put LGBTQ people especially at risk, since same-sex marriage is illegal in Indonesia. Maulana Yusran is the deputy chief of Indonesia's Tourism Industry Board. Yusran said the new code was, quote, totally counterproductive at a time when the economy and tourism were starting to recover from the pandemic. The new laws won't take effect for 3 years, but they also ban insulting the president or state institutions, spreading views counter to the state ideology, and staging protests without notification. They also include more lenient sentences for those charged with corruption. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, quote, "We are concerned about how the law could impact U.S. citizens visiting and living in Indonesia, as well as the investment climate for U.S. companies," end quote.
When a child suffers abuse or neglect, experts recognize that it can result in long-term behavioral health issues. But there's a growing body of research about the impact it can have on a person's physical health, including on their heart. Mike Moen has more from South Dakota.
Child abuse prevention specialists in South Dakota and elsewhere say a new study underscores the need to protect kids from traumatic situations to avoid long-term physical health issues. International researchers have found a 14% increase in heart failure among adults who experienced one form of childhood maltreatment. Those with 3 to 5 types of maltreatment had a 43% increased risk. Brooke Jones, a child abuse pediatrician based in Sioux Falls, says these events place stressors on the body.
If you've heard of the term fight or flight, if you're having constant adversity in your childhood, you might be in a constant flight stage, meaning that you don't have any down regulation or you're not getting out of that constant stress environment.
And that constant stress can leave its mark in multiple ways, including cardiovascular disease, as these kids transition to adulthood. Jones says parents or caregivers can reduce the impact by providing a nurturing environment as the child grows. She says it can involve simple things such as reading to them or finding ways to let them know they're in a safe space. Shakira Sulia of Emory University chaired a 2017 American Heart Association report that tied adverse childhood experiences to adult health risks, including heart disease. She says the new study adds to evidence that the mental and physical health effect go hand in hand when peeling back the layers of trauma.
There might be, you know, development of a depression or anxiety disorders that may make someone more prone to then cope with substances. For example, the uptake of smoking is also another thing that people tend to use to really cope with stress.
Sulia echoes calls for policymakers and community-level organizations to do anything that supports stronger family relationships, especially in situations where trauma has surfaced in a household. She says outside of the home, schools and care centers can be on alert for children who have dealt with trauma and should try to emphasize a welcoming environment in those settings. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
Farmers are working to educate young people about agriculture and the food system in hopes of getting kids interested in being part of the next generation of farming. But there are still myths and challenges to overcome while doing that work. Edwin J. Vieira has more on educating kids on farming and the myth-busting that goes along with it in Virginia.
Farmers in and around Virginia are working to educate children about agriculture and provide a deeper understanding of their work. These programs don't just teach kids about farming, but are designed for them to understand where their food comes from. Other goals include dispelling certain ideals about what farming is. Tyrone Power Cherry III with the Petersburg League of Urban Growers is working to show the benefits of farming to youths in the area. One thing he hopes kids will learn is that farming is for everyone.
You automatically assume that it's old white guys that farm, and they do it in places that are not urban. They do it in rural areas, or what a kid would say is they do it in the country. So what we're dispelling right now is we're introducing them to urban agriculture, which is sort of different. The way I explain it to the youth is, like, you might have heard jazz, you might have heard different types of music, but then you heard hip-hop.
He adds other misconceptions he's working to dispel are that farming is only done in rural areas, and involves backbreaking labor. As a longtime educator, he feels the goal of education is empowerment. By teaching the kids about farming and agriculture, he wants them to understand that they are the future of that industry. He says this is a way to improve the area and lift it up from being a food desert. Catherine Ekman with New Roots Community Farm says watching kids learn about food has been interesting. She finds kids are learning what makes an area a food desert and how to alleviate this issue. Ekman describes one of the bigger challenges as getting families to understand how local and healthier foods can be accessible.
I think a lot of families in the area, they didn't grow up with the same opportunities that their students are, and so they kind of maybe have a little bit of rejection around farm to school, and they see things like local food, organic food, things like that, and they're like, that's not for us.
In the future, Ekman hopes to have high school students join the program and have them learn how to plan and profit from crops. She hopes to aid high schoolers who are interested in farming by connecting them to scholarships that would further their education. Overall, she wants to ensure kids have access to fresh fruits and vegetables and to enhance their agricultural horizons. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, Virginia News Connection.
Three Alaska students are leading the push to remove the SQ word, a slur against Indigenous women, from place names. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. 1 year ago, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland issued a declaration to remove the SQ word, a slur against Indigenous women, from place names on federal lands. Nearly 650 new names were finalized this fall, including in Dillingham, Alaska. As KDLG's Izzy Ross reports, three elementary students had pushed to change the name long before the federal government started its process.
Alora Wassily, Trista Wassily, and Harmony Larson have worked to change the creek's name since 2021. That finally happened in September. In an interview shortly after the announcement, Alora said they had put a lot of effort into reaching that goal.
It feels good because we worked on it for so long and it finally got changed, and we just feel relieved. We felt accomplished.
They began advocating for the change when they were in fifth grade, after they had heard a local story about seven sisters who had lived along the creek, and how both the creek and a road of the same name were marked with the derogatory word. Now they're in seventh grade. Robin Cheney helped the students prepare. She's the federal programs coordinator for Dillingham City Schools and has been an adult advisor for the students.
Them standing behind their information was really powerful. They were part of educating people here, including myself.
The students are the latest in a long legacy of work to recenter Native place names in Bristol Bay. Francisca Demoski is the land manager for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. She oversees the land department's cultural heritage efforts, including the Bristol Bay Native Place Names Project. She says it's one of the ways the corporation celebrates and preserves that heritage.
Amau Creek translates to great-grandparent and is a Yuchtun word. And in this case, it references a group of sisters or great-grandmothers who, according to traditional stories, traveled to the area and settled near the creek. So the community recognized the role of the great-grandmothers in their families and chose the name to honor their ancestors.
The students' work isn't over. They are now focused on the next steps to change the community's signs and replace them with the new name, Amau Creek. For National Native News, I'm Izzy Ross.
President Biden plans to designate the nation's newest national monument in southern Nevada. As Arizona Public Radio's Brian Heinches reports, the 450,000-acre expanse is sacred to at least a dozen tribes.
The Avi Kwame National Monument would include Spirit Mountain and the surrounding Mojave Desert landscape 80 miles south of Las Vegas. It's considered the origin point for the Hualapai, Havasupai, Maricopa, and several other tribes, and is also a sacred site for the Hopi. The 5,600-foot peak itself was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1999 for its tribal significance. Indigenous leaders and environmental groups say the designation will connect several other biologically diverse protected areas and provide vital habitat and migration corridors for bighorn sheep, desert tortoise, and other species. The new monument would span an area in the southern tip of Nevada between Arizona and the Colorado River to the California Mojave National Preserve. Biden made the announcement at the recent White White House Tribal Nations Summit, the designation hasn't been made final, but tribes, conservationists, and others applauded the announcement. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Tis the season of Santa, but KBOO News poet Dan Raphael just wants some sanity.
Maybe now that the courts have blocked Measure 114, folks won't have to line up at gun shops at 6 a.m., and store Santas won't have to worry about men in camo waiting for their turn. Portland got a thin crust of snow, but they didn't close the schools because it was Sunday. Meanwhile, Ukraine is sending drones into Russia. A U.S. judge ruled that the Saudi crown prince had sovereign immunity in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. China hasn't changed or revealed anything from the protests and lockdowns, and the recent COP summit was a corporate-enhanced farce. At least enough Georgians weren't warped enough to vote in Herschel Walker. A little sanity in the South is a sliver of hope. I wish we could have a truly new year, starting any time, but change doesn't work that way. We just get new calendars and an excuse to party hardy and resolve to be better selves while the world around us continues to wobble. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscasts includes Dan Raphael and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Tegetoff, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Mohn. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K.